Bridget opened her eyes, striving for inner balance as always after a Mattrans jump. From the hyperdimensional non-space through which she had traveled, she seemed to fall through vertiginous abysses. There was a micro-instant of non-existence, then a shock as her senses returned. Bridget had read the accounts written by Mildred Wyeth when she and her companions had been forced to jump blind without the knowledge of how to program specific destination points. She described the symptoms of jump sickness, the pain and nightmares she and her comrades had suffered while traversing the Deathlands via the Mattrans network. Even now, with all the hyperdimensional pathways routed and the destination codes pre-programmed, jumping was still not the most comfortable way to travel. It felt like a fleeting brush with death. Bridget struggled against a spasm of nausea and blinked. The silvery shimmer had faded from the hexagonal metal discs on the floor. She tried to focus through the last of the mist wisping over her helmet's faceplate. Listening to the doctor's breathing, Bridget pushed herself up, leaning against the wall. DeFore stirred beside her.
No wonder Grant hates these damn things.
Bridget looked around the chamber, and for a second the color of the armorglass walls confused her. They were tinted brown, and by the dim overhead light in the center of the ceiling panels, they looked the same shade as the Cerberus units. On closer inspection, she realized the brown was darker and deeper, not the rich earth tones of the chamber in Montana, but the color of swamp mud.
That's appropriate.
What?
Nothing.
Bridget arose, swaying slightly on unsteady legs. DeFore slowly climbed to her feet, her respiration less strained now. She glanced down at the rad counter.
Mid-range green. Safe enough.
Going to the door, Bridget threw her companion a reassuring smile.
Here's the part I like best. Opening a chamber door to reveal God knows what.
Unlike DeFore, Bridget had materialized in a number of redoubts over the past year, and she knew pretty much what to expect. Most of the installations that she, Kane, and Grant visited had been built to standard specs. Generally, the gateway chamber of the complex was situated in the deepest, most reinforced section, as far from the main entrance as possible. Once she opened the door, Bridget expected to see an anteroom opening onto a control room. Outside the control room, they would most likely find a corridor, as in Cerberus, leading to other parts of the redoubt in one direction and in the other to an exterior sector, either open or closed. While the jump chambers were self-enclosed, the designers had built an anteroom and a wall between the master controls and the gateway units themselves. These provided something of a buffer zone between the forces unleashed by the Mattrans and the software of the complicated computer system. Heaving up on the wedge-shaped handle, Bridget disengaged the lock solenoid and shouldered the door open. To her surprise, not only did it require more effort than usual, but she also heard the screech of rusty pivot hinges, a sound she had never heard before in any jump chamber. When she pushed the door open enough to see past it, she beheld a sight she had never seen in any redoubt, or anywhere else for that matter. She could see clear across the antechamber into the comp-controlled room, with its rows of consoles and desks. Colored indicator lights danced on the hard drive bays, and auto-circuitry still clicked and whirred purposefully, but those were the only sights similar to the redoubts she had seen before. Seated in plugs of melted wax atop the control panels, votive candles shed a sputtering, sickly illumination, winking like demonic flickering eyes from the shadows. Bridget and DeFore stood in the open door of the gateway chamber, one of the highest and greatest of mankind's technological achievements, and looked at a place torn from the Dark Ages, born from ancient nightmares. Where the ceiling met the walls, drapes of thick gray cobwebs hung. All the tables and shelves and consoles were state-of-the-art, but they groaned beneath the impediments and tools of forgotten black sciences. There were glass and clay jars, some packed with what looked like wads of dried human flesh, others with cloudy liquids in different shades of pink and yellow. Yellowed skulls, some animal, some human, grinned down from the higher shelves. Intertwined braids of herbs, moss, desiccated birds, and mummified reptiles dangled from hooks in the ceiling. The floor and walls were crisscrossed with pentagrams and confusing designs drawn in a dull, rusty red. Small bones lay scattered within them. To Bridget's shocked senses, the redoubt had been turned into a combination of cathedral, sorcerer's den, and trash dump.
I thought this redoubt was supposed to be a medical facility.
Apparently, somebody decided to redecorate.
Who?
I don't know.
Getting into a redoubt from the outside wasn't as simple as opening a door and strolling in. The sectors required the entry of a 3-digit access code, 352, input into an electronic keypad. Although it was conceivable that some swamp dweller had devoted the time to experimenting, punching in the myriad combinations, she experienced the shuddery feeling that wasn't what happened here. The two women moved through the antechamber, towing aside debris and being careful not to tread on the intricate designs drawn on the floor. They passed through the control room and out into the main corridor. The floor was just as littered with rubbish as in the antechamber and control room, and the walls were painted with the same whirling symbols. Open doors lined the passageway, and a couple bore plastic signs bolted to the bulkheads beside them. In faded print, they read, "Biohazard Area." The women entered several rooms at random, finding most of them bare and stripped, dusty and dirt-encrusted. One of the rooms seemed to be a central barracks with the detritus of the culture that had thrived before the bombs fell. Empty soda cans and disposable cups, candy wrappers, browned photographs on desktops, and crumbling paper memos tacked to bulletin boards. All undisturbed, all telltale signs of men and women who had been forced to leave in a hurry. Within a partitioned alcove, they saw a whirlpool bath, the sides of the tub rising 3 feet from the floor. On the far side of the living area, they found a heavy door with a simple steel pushbar release. It bore a sign that declared, "Entry to this biohazard section absolutely forbidden to all personnel below B-12 clearance."
Vitamins?
What?
The B-12 security clearance always makes me think of vitamins.
Pushing open the door, they stepped into an adjoining chamber. They saw the carcass of a mainframe computer and rows of chemical analysis machines. Fetishes and totems of human hair and animal carcasses hung from the ceiling.
What do you make of all this?
Well, my best guess is a form of purification, according to voodoo or some other tribal rites.
How did anybody get in here to do all of this?
I can't even guess at that.
I'm glad we're wearing the suits and the helmets. Something tells me the smell in this place is really ungodly.
They walked between two long trestle tables bearing a large glass filtration and purification system and circled around a stainless steel liquid nitrogen tank. The lid was open, revealing the honeycomb pattern of individual containers that had once held blood samples. The women went through a door on the far side of the room and found themselves in a side corridor. The overhead neon strips were unlighted, but dim sunlight was finding its way somehow into the hall, filtering down a stairwell at the end of the passageway.
Some part of this redoubt is open to the outside.
Then it seems like there should be vermin in here. Bugs, bats, or rats.
Bridget pointed toward the skull of what appeared to be a muskrat lying in a corner.
Maybe they know better.
Unleathering her blaster, Bridget led the way up the stairs. Looking up, she saw a greenish-yellow glimmer as of milky sunlight suffused through dense foliage. As she climbed, she debated with herself about retracing their steps and going back to the jump chamber to return to Cerberus. Taking samples of the organic tissue in the jars might suffice for testing for the plague bacillus. But she continued climbing until she reached the top. It was there she found the man, and a glance told her he was dying. Lying on his side on the floor, he was dark-skinned and dark-haired. A dew of agony glistened on his face. He wore only a ragged loincloth and a small crucifix of hammered silver set with tiny beads around his neck. His limbs were like sticks. His eyes were milky and suppurating in their sockets. His lips had peeled back from blackened gums and rotting teeth. Several of them looked loose in their sockets. His body was pocked with inflamed lesions and eruptions, and from these leaked a pale, thin fluid. The skin beneath his armpits was swollen so taut it was splitting. The flesh was a purple-black in color and shone with little poisonous beads of moisture. Crimson tendrils spilled from his slack lips. As DeFore caught up to her, Bridget gazed in horror at the man, her throat constricting.
Oh, no.
DeFore noted his shallow, rapid rate of respiration. Immediately, she went to her knees beside the man, placing her medical kit on the floor and raising the lid. Bridget expected her to fill a hypodermic from one of the bottles of medication, but instead, DeFore removed a small culture dish and a tiny needle.
Aren't you going to inject him with one of the antibiotics?
There's no point. He's too far gone, in the last stages of pneumonia. All I can do is take blood and sputum cultures.
Pinching the ball of the man's left thumb, DeFore pricked it with the point of the needle. A pearl of scarlet oozed out, and she swiped it over a layer of gel in the culture dish. The man was completely oblivious to what she was doing. A shudder worked along Bridget's spine, and a sense of enormous peril settled over her. It seemed to her that black blotches spread across the man's face even as she watched. Quickly, she turned away and cautiously stepped to the open doors to look around. Thick tropical foliage rose on all sides, turning the late afternoon sunlight to little more than a dull greenish haze. Cypress trees loomed high, as well as nut-laden pecan trees and sycamores, all of them nearly smothered by tangles of Spanish moss and snarls of creeper vines. Just looking at the humid emerald hell made her break a sweat, despite the internal thermostats of the environmental suit. Examining the sectors, she concluded they hadn't been forced open, but she saw how damp earth, mold, leaves, and twigs had accumulated between the double-walled thickness of the frame. Obviously, the doors had been open for quite some time. She returned to the head of the stairs just as DeFore ran a cotton swab over the man's lips. When the tip had absorbed bloody spittle, she put the swab in a culture dish, sealed it, and returned it to the medical kit. Gently, with thumb and forefinger, she closed the man's eyes.
Oh, he's dead. No amount of antibiotics would have done him any good.
Closing the case, DeFore stood up.
We got the samples we came for, but they're probably superfluous. It's the Black Death. Sure enough.
Bridget and DeFore went back down the stairs and began to retrace their steps. They had walked only a few yards when Bridget became aware of a strange surging motion in the shadows ahead of them. Clicking on her Nighthawk, she directed the amber beam forward. It glinted from moving specks of light. They were like tiny red sparks, but they moved in pairs, seeming to ooze out of the murk. The flashlight beam illuminated gibbous shadow shapes, shuffling and extending claw-tipped, hairless paws toward them. Whiskers twitched, and saliva-damp incisor teeth champed.
Rats.
Lots of rats. Big ones, too.
Sweeping her microlight back and forth, she noticed how the rats were bloated, almost lethargic except for the questing movements of their snouts and forepaws. One of the creatures, the size of a terrier, turned its head directly into the fanning glow of the microlight. Where its eyes should have been, there were only slime-covered purplish patches of wet, scabrous tissue. The rat didn't react to the light.
And diseased.
What are we gonna do?
I don't think they can bite through the suits, but I don't want to have them crawling all over us either.
They're between us and the gateway. We'll have to go through them.
Bridget extended the pistol, drawing a bead on the blind rodent.
Maybe I can scare them off.
She squeezed the trigger, and the head of the rat burst like a water balloon, spraying blood, fur, and brain matter in all directions. Bridget waited to see how the rats would react to it. Rather than scampering away, they rolled forward in a wave, hairless tails thrashing, claws ticking on the floor. Bridget stood her ground, firing the autoblaster. The round struck the rats with piledriver force, obliterating heads and bodies in clouds of gore. The rodents continued to sweep forward. Bridget tried to tell herself that the rat's teeth couldn't penetrate the tough fabric of the suits she and DeFore wore, but the sight of the fur-covered swarm triggered an instinctive atavistic reaction in her. She stopped shooting and ran back toward the steps. DeFore was at her side. Neither woman screamed. They kept their breath for running. The two of them pelted up the stairway. Because the helmets reduced peripheral vision, the toe of Bridget's boot snagged on a riser. She stumbled forward. She caught herself on the steps with both hands. A weight slammed into her upper back before she recovered her footing. Even through the multi-layered fabric, she felt claws seeking to secure a hold. A cold sweat of irrational terror poured down her face. Another weight latched onto her lower right leg, and she could feel the pressure of razor-keen incisors trying to gnaw through the suit at the center of her calf. Trying to rise and twist at the same time, Bridget flailed behind her with the barrel of the autoblaster. The metal connected solidly, but the squirming weight remained on her back. She caught a blurred glimpse of the rodent horde streaming and scampering around her like furry floodwaters. Then a rat launched itself from the heaving mass. It slapped against her faceplate, the impact staggering her sideways. All she could see was a bloated, naked underbelly, a crawl with black fleas and shockingly human-like paws scrabbling for purchase on the plexiglass. Hammering with her fist, her gun barrel, Bridget rose to her feet, kicking and stamping, feeling bodies squash and break beneath her heavy boot treads. Gritting her teeth, she closed her gloved fingers around the rat on her helmet and pried it off. It snapped viciously at her hand before she flung it away. DeFore stood at the top of the steps, slapping and beating at the rats climbing her legs. One clung to her bosom, its snout buried in the Supertech 3 weave, teeth worrying at it. Heart pounding, Bridget stomped and waded through the boiling mass of hair, claws, and lashing tails.
Run! They can't hurt us!
If DeFore comprehended her words, she gave no sign. She batted at the rodents, scaling her like a tree. Weighted down with rats, Bridget fought her way to the top of the stairs, grabbed DeFore by the arm, and pulled her out of the redoubt. They plunged through the foliage. Bridget had no idea of a destination, only that they needed some maneuvering room. She was sure they could outrun most of the rats, as sick as they were. As their feet pounded on the marshy ground, Bridget used the barrel of the Ivor Johnson as a bludgeon, whacking the rats clinging to DeFore, knocking them, writhing and broken, into the overgrowth. DeFore squeezed the creature hanging onto the front of her suit until it opened its jaws to snap at her hands. The doctor hurled it as far away as she could. Bridget pushed ahead of her companion, leading with her blaster, clearing a path through the tangle. Because of the helmet and zippered collar, Bridget couldn't swivel her head for a quick over-the-shoulder glance. She had to more or less pivot at the waist to see if the rats were in pursuit, trying not to break stride. She saw nothing behind them but foliage, whipped by their passage. She could still feel the weight of the two rats tenaciously clinging onto her, and DeFore carried an unwanted passenger as well between her shoulder blades. It clung by its teeth, body bouncing and tail lashing in rhythm to her sprinting footfalls. Then Bridget felt her feet adhere to the ground and jerk her to a violent, staggering stop. Reaching out as she stumbled forward, she dropped her autoblaster while she sought something to grab onto, but no stopgap was to be found. She fell headlong into the morass. DeFore managed to keep her balance, but she also started to sink into the thick, semi-liquid mud as quickly as Bridget. Directly in front of her, the face-down form of Bridget thrashed, struggling in the mire. DeFore's eyes darted around, searching for any fallen piece of wood or vine within reach, but finding none. The tepid mix of soil, water, and other foul-smelling liquids was now up to their waists, and they continued to sink steadily.
This shit is like quicksand. The more you struggle, the quicker you go down.
Bridget managed to raise her head clear, but the faceplate of her helmet was occluded with slime, and trying to wipe it off only smeared it further. She noticed that the rats on both of their bodies had scampered as far as possible from the gelid surface of the bog, perching atop their helmets. The two women took turns swatting the rodents off. They fell into the mire with splats and struggled only briefly before sinking out of sight. Neither Bridget nor DeFore was concerned by the fear of drowning, but the prospect of sinking farther into the quagmire, trapped at the bottom in the darkness until they exhausted their individual air supplies, was terrifying. The last to suffocate would have to listen to the death gasps and rattles of the first to go.
What are we gonna do?
Before Bridget could formulate an answer, the mud and debris on the upper layer of the quagmire began to froth and foam. From the midst of the muddy maelstrom, a human head thrust up. Despite the sludge and slime streaming down the man's face, the women saw the intricate network of raw red cuts around both of his eyes. As more scarred heads began to rise from the muck, the man's lips stretched in a smile, and he spoke. Neither woman should have been able to hear through the walls of their helmets, but somehow they did.
My name is Doyle. We've been waiting for you.
Cain was falling, and as he plummeted faster and faster, he knew he was dreaming. How many dreams in a lifetime, Cain wondered aloofly. How many forgotten in the light of day? More unconscious journeys than could ever be remembered. And were daydreams included? No, for they allowed the dreamer to possess at least a modicum of control. Amazing the kinds of fused-out thoughts that flew through a man's mind when falling in a dream. Time seemed to hang still and motionless, even while racing forward like a runaway warway, crashing down and over the precipice of a sheer dark cliff, a kind of out-of-control stability. As for this kind of dream, the number of those exactly matched the number of Mattrans jumps Cain had taken. There were times when he felt he spent more time caught on the cusp of infinity than in his own conscious form. He tried to call out into the dreamscape surrounding his falling body, but no sound would come. The only noise he could hear was inside his chest. The oxygen within his lungs was echoing heavily with the dull thud, thud, thud of an infinite number of air sacs expanding open and slamming shut. With each new open and closing sound, he felt his lungs constrict. One would think falling across the sky would provide him more than enough air, yet for some reason he was unable to catch a single breath. Overhead, the world was filled with stars. There was no horizon, no land, no earth, and he realized he was surrounded by an inky black curtain dusted with a million sequins of starlight. Suddenly, he was more than merely Cain. He was a man ready and able to defend flag and country as an astronaut in a faceless helmet and bulky spacesuit. He wasn't sure where that imagery came from. He retained splinters of memory from the third lost Earth he had visited, the parallel casement where his alternate world self commanded a spaceship named Saber. The depths of outer space, at least in this dream, were colder than any of the previous bleak environments he'd been forced to slog through. He gritted his teeth. His vision blurred, and the stars seemed to streak across the blackness. He blinked, squinted, blinked again, and took in the sight of the universe that surrounded him. Then came the falling, and the stars, and the dream, and now it was time to wake up. Kane breathed in, breathed out. Time to wake up.
He's waking up. He's waking up. He's waking up. I don't think he's feeling any pain.
He shouldn't be feeling much at all. Not after the way I juiced him up with sedatives. He's probably had some vivid dreams, though.
Kane's eyelids lifted partway. The lighting was muted, diffused, and the world looked strange. Shadowy figures moved, wavered back and forth. The walls were white, the ceiling lit by a neon strip. He tried to sit up. The bed spun. He grasped the high rails on the sides and squeezed his eyes shut again until the spasm of vertigo passed.
Ugh. I'm guessing we made it.
Grant came to the bedside and gently pushed Kane back onto the mattress. He held up a slender dart, revolving it between thumb and forefinger.
Barely. You got this in the ass right before we closed the sec door.
It all came back to Kane in a rush. The stumbling flight through the jungle, trading the Indians' blowgun shots for those from their sin-eaters. Just when they thought they had eluded the Amazonians, a howling mob of Indians had erupted from the jungle in a final do-or-die assault.
Ugh, shit. How long have I been out?
7 hours.
You were exhausted and dehydrated. I gave you a sedative so your system could metabolize the narcotic while you slept.
Kane turned his head to see Auerbach standing in the doorway that led to the laboratory.
You gave me a sedative? Who put you back on duty? Where's DeFore?
Auerbach didn't meet his slit-eyed gaze.
Away. In Louisiana, I'm told.
Bridget, too.
Memories of being stalked by swampies crowded into Kane's mind.
Why would they go to that hell zone?
Lakesh said they went to wreck a redoubt down there to identify the disease that Samariumville reported. Remember that?
I remember. How long have they been gone?
Little over 7 hours. They jumped out maybe a minute before we jumped in.
They weren't supposed to be gone this long. The wreck to Redoubt 47 shouldn't have taken more than 2 hours, three at the outside. With the ComSat relay system offline, there is no way to monitor their biosigns.
And so you just took over from DeFore?
I'm the most qualified.
Impatiently, Kane tossed the sheet aside and swung his legs over the side of the bed. His head spun dizzily for a moment, then it passed.
Give me some clothes.
Grant fetched him a white bodysuit. Kane started getting dressed.
I told Lakesh what happened to us, what was done to Domi.
And?
And the highest of those Indians' gods is Kukul Khan, a plumed serpent. Blue and white are his holy colors.
So that's why they painted up Domi.
Yeah. They thought she was pure of heart and soul, if you can imagine that.
It's beyond my ability. So what? When those poor stoops found a muty snake, they rigged it out in feathers and kept it like an earthly manifestation of their god?
Right. They weren't gonna so much sacrifice Domi as marry her to it. Of course, once the marriage was consummated, she would have ended up in the damn thing's digestive tract. But all in all, it would have been a great honor.
Kane zipped up the front of the suit and stood.
And what role were you playing, maid of honor?
Grant gingerly touched his left shoulder.
Something like that, I guess.
Did you get that cut treated?
Auerbach sterilized and stitched me up.
I've dealt with worse.
Kane gave him another narrow-eyed glare.
Anyway, it's no wonder the Indians were so pissed off at us. Not only did we bust up the wedding, but we chilled the groom.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have lasted anyway.
Kind of funny when you think about it. Those Indians thought they had a god in the bowl. To us, it was just a monster.
I guess the difference between gods and monsters is only a matter of perception. Let's find out what's going on with Baptiste and DeFore.
Kane and Grant strode into the ops complex. Farrell, Kata, and Bry were there, manning various stations. So was Lakesh, pacing back and forth beneath the Mercator map, eyeing all the glowing lights and lines as if they were the source of his agitation. Domi stood nearby, gnawing nervously on a thumbnail. She wore her usual redoubt ensemble of short, sleeveless red jerkin belted at the waist, which left her gammon-slim legs bare to the upper thigh. Her skin, scrubbed clean of the blue paint, gleamed like polished porcelain. As Kane walked past her, he gave her a conspiratorial wink.
You decided to go back to the original color scheme, I see. You looked good in blue.
Kiss my ass.
Ah, friend Kane, up and about at last.
Kane looked over at the old man and saw worry shadowing his eyes and deepening the seams and creases in his face.
I have some unsettling news.
Grant already briefed me. Why didn't you tell DeFore and Baptiste to wait until we got back?
I can't tell anyone to do anything any longer, remember? You were instrumental in that.
Kane understood the old man's resentment at his self-perceived authority being usurped, but he also knew it was misplaced. The cooperation among the Cerberus exiles was by agreement. There were security protocols to be observed, certain assigned duties that had to be performed, but anything other than that was a matter of persuasion and volunteerism. There was no formal oath like the ones he and Grant had taken upon admission into the Magistrate Division, nor a system of penalties if cooperation was not given. Nor was there a hard and fast system of government within the Cerberus Redoubt. Lakesh had never truly held the reins of power in the first place. Still, his ability to manipulate his colleagues had been diminished when Kane, Grant, and Bridget began to understand his methods and rebel against them.
Frankly, I expressed my doubts about the value of their mission, but my protests were disregarded.
But for them to jump into the middle of a possible biohazard...
With the environmental suits, they could materialize into a giant petri dish full of the Ebola virus and still be safe.
Then why haven't they come back?
Wagging his head in doleful frustration, Lakesh waved to the map over their heads.
I can't even speculate. The jump line to Redoubt 47 still reads active, so it's not a malfunction in the gateway unit down there.
I hope they weren't stupid enough to expand their wreck out of the redoubt. Those bios are triple dangerous places, I should know.
You were many miles from Redoubt 47, in the vicinity of Redoubt Delta.
So? The place was still crawling with carnivorous plants, mosquitoes the size of Grant's head, not to mention swampies.
You were in one of their settlements, Boontown, right?
Right.
Kane repressed a shiver when he recollected the zombie-like swampies who, with their double circulatory systems, were virtually unkillable.
They must have run into something, or they would have been back here by now.
That is possible, but there are any number of possibilities for their delay.
Too damn many. Grant, I think we should go count just how many.
Grant's eyebrows drew together, a deep vertical furrow forming above the bridge of his nose.
Are you sure you're up to it? Stuff on those darts really packs a wallop.
It sure as hell does. I still feel wobbly.
How about you, Grant? Are you wobbly?
Yeah, a little bit. I didn't have the benefit of sedatives and sleep to counteract the effects of the toxin. I had to bleed and sweat it out.
Kane ran a contemplative hand over the 3 days' worth of beard stubble on his chin. He cast an expectant glance toward Lakesh.
What's your opinion about going after them?
You're asking me for my input? Actually soliciting an opinion? Be still, my beating heart. I may need a second transplant.
Bry and Domi turned their faces away to hide their smiles.
Old man, I don't recall saying that all of your ideas were lousy. Or that your particular take on something was worthless.
You implied as much.
You may have interpreted it that way, due to your vil-sized ego, but I never meant it that way. The question still stands. Should we or should we not give Baptiste and DeFore more time before we jump after them?
Just before dearest Bridget made the Matrans jump, she tried to ask me something. I couldn't hear her very clearly because of her helmet. Later, I understood what she asked. I took the liberty of reviewing her last activity in the database.
What's that got to do with...
Hear me out. After accessing the same file she accessed, I fear something is going on down in the swamps that may portend something other than an outbreak of the plague. In fact, the epidemic may be only an outward manifestation of something far worse.
You mean it was deliberately released?
Kane's stomach roiled slightly with the old fear of manufactured diseases getting loose from buried installations, either by accident or by design.
Yes and no.
God damn it. What's Bridget's computer activity got to do with the bubonic plague?
I'm getting to that.
Then get to it already.
My interest in physics always superseded my interest in everything else, except, as you know, for mythology. My grandfather instilled in me a fascination for it with his tales of Ravana and his Rakshasas.
Rak what?
The Rakshasas are the unholy family of Hindu myth. Their lord is Ravana. They were dedicated evildoers who strove to defeat the gods, sometimes winning, sometimes losing.
Hell of a family.
There is Pichasas, who functions like a vampire and spreads foul diseases like leprosy. Butas, his kindred spirit, can actually force the dead to rise from their graves and attack the living. Grachas is a demon of disease who infects humans by penetrating orifices. This is the family of the Rakshasas. In other languages, they were called the Old Ones.
There's a point to all of this, I'm hoping.
There is. But how can I tell you with any conviction of all the things crowded into my mind as the result of my grandfather's strange tales? Of powerful beings of unbelievable evil, old gods who once inhabited the earth, driven away, yet returning, becoming manifest briefly, horribly, to the world of men.
And once again, I still don't see what this has to do with Bridget's last activity in the database.
Judging from the files we discovered prior to Bridget and the good doctors jumped Redoubt 47, it seems likely that some of the biomedical techniques that were being experimented with for the Enterprise Eternity Project had their basis in some sort of genetic material that may come from a kind of creature that could be interpreted as one of the beings from these myths. And look here.
Lakesh pointed their attention to the scowl report Baptiste had found and waited for them to read it. When they were finished, Grant and Kane exchanged looks but said nothing. Folding his arms over his chest, Lakesh tilted his head at a defiant angle.
You may dispense with the aspersions you're planning to cast on my sanity, or lack thereof. I assure you I am not, to employ your vernacular, fused out. I merely related to you the files Bridget accessed and how they relate to my own knowledge of similar phenomena and entities.
So, we've got an old one down in Louisiana who may or may not be a vampire or a Rakshasa, who may or may not be somehow related to Enterprise Eternity, and who may or may not have been killed over 175 years ago by a soldier of the Scow, and who may or may not be back spreading the bubonic plague.
You know, it sounds like such bullshit when you put it that way.
Sounds like bullshit any way it's put. But the problem is, if you look at the possibility objectively, it makes as much sense as some of the ops we've already been on.
Oh, come on. You're not seriously buying into this.
Until we know otherwise, why the hell not?
I'm sitting this one out.
Don't tell me you believe this crap.
It's not that. Had enough truck with gods lately. Besides, I've seen a lot of strange things in the Outlands. Things I've never told you or anybody else about.
Indeed. Like what?
You two can compare your strange tales later. There are still two environmental suits in the armory, right?
Three, actually.
Kane glanced up at the Mercator map, then started walking toward the door.
Let's suit up.
I can tell this is gonna be another long night.
Bridget opened her eyes. She saw that she lay inside a lean-to made of lashed-together saplings, but her head ached with confusion and noise. The glare from the bonfire peeping in through rents in the square of cloth hanging in the front of the low entrance hurt her eyes. She squinted, blinked, and squinted again. Black figures, backlit against the crimson tongues of flame, shifted in and out of her limited field of vision. Memory and awareness returned simultaneously in a rush. She lay on her right side on the marshy ground, wrists bound behind her. Her fingertips were numb, and she couldn't tell by touch the material of her bonds. Folding her fingers into fists, she strained against them, but she felt no slack, no give whatsoever. Still, she felt a dull wonder that she was still alive. After a couple of false starts, she managed to sit up. Pain thumped at the back of her head. Nausea assailed her, and she fought the desire to vomit. She could taste the tang of blood in her mouth, felt and smelled it caked in her nostrils. She twitched convulsively when, by the firelight flickering in through the tears in the hanging, she saw she was naked. Blue and black bruises showed on her thighs, reddening welts marring her legs. She remembered hands lifting her from the quagmire, then ripping the environmental suit from her body, as well as the one-piece garment she wore beneath it. She also remembered fighting, punching, kicking, and gouging for eyes. She glimpsed DeFore doing the same thing, at least for a few seconds, then a fist fell onto the back of Bridget's neck, and the impact jarred all the way down her spine, blurring her vision. A torrent of blows fell. There had been nothing fancy about a close and personal beating, and that was what she'd received. She'd swung her own fists during this, or at least she hoped she had. By then, all her actions were nothing but a blur of agony, and for every blow she landed, three more crashed into her body. Bridget told herself that she put up a damn good fight, but ultimately, it wasn't good enough. DeFore wasn't in the lean-to with her, but Bridget refused to surrender to the fear the woman was dead. Inching around, she leaned forward, peering out through a rip in the drapery. At first, she could make nothing of what she saw. All was shadowy and chaotic, shapes moving and mingling, writhing and twisting. Black formless figures etched starkly against the leaping flames of the bonfire. The whites of rolling eyeballs, the flash of grinning teeth reflected the firelight. She saw short people, broad-shouldered and deep-chested, naked except for ragged shorts, some little more than loincloths. The firelight sculpted their swelling muscles and their dark, scarred faces. Beyond them, the ribbon of a wide stream glimmered in the moonlight. Her eyes watered in the steady glare of the flames, and she glanced away, then repressed a cry of horror. A few feet away rose a low pyramid built of gory human heads. Dead, glassy eyes stared up at the black sky. Twisting her head away from the ghastly spectacle, Bridget again struggled with the urge to retch. Shuddering and shaking, she swallowed down the acid bile that rose in a burning column up her throat. Since joining the Cerberus Exiles, she had witnessed torture and torment all over the world, but she had never grown accustomed to it or accepted it. She never would. The hanging was roughly thrust aside, and a man-shape blotted out the firelight. Bridget instinctively retreated backward, bare heels digging into the ground. She pressed against the rear sapling wall. She waited for the man to speak. He didn't. Bridget was taken aback. She hadn't heard a wolf whistle in a very long time. Not since her early 20s, when she walked the promenade of the enclaves in Cobaltville. Since her exile, she was usually next to Cain in any given situation when other men were present, so admirers tended to keep their expressions of interest in her to themselves. Ducking his head, the man entered the lean-to, crouching. She recognized his freshly scarred face. Doyle looked to be in his early 30s, and no more than 5'8". His eyes were tiny bits of black tinged with hints of piercing cobalt blue, which added to his sinister appearance. He was dressed in denim of different colors and textures, the pants blue and the jacket light tan. He wore a red flannel long-sleeve shirt missing a few buttons, and the gaps showed off the tight t-shirt he wore underneath. On his feet were basic combat boots. He kept the cuffs of the denims tucked into the tops, giving his lower legs a puffed-out look.
Hello, gorgeous. What's a nice girl like you doing in a hell pit like this?
You have got to be kidding.
What? I'm not good enough to ask you questions?
Exactly.
That's not very friendly.
Neither were you or your swampy friends, as I recall.
You and your friend are our guests. If I were you, I'd be a little more receptive of our hospitality. Okajnik sets great store by it.
Bridget did not allow the surge of relief Doyle's remark about her friend triggered to show on her face.
Where is my friend?
Here, in another guest accommodation.
We're not your guests. We're here because we were attacked and abducted. If you don't like my attitude, then that's too bad. Excuse me all to hell. I hate hurting such a big man's feelings. If this Okajnik has a problem with my attitude, I'll be glad to take it up with him personally.
I don't think you'd like that.
Skin crawling, Bridget looked around and saw tiny eyes gleaming between the saplings.
They don't like it either.
Rats.
Rats. A whole army of infected rats.
How did you train them?
They aren't trained. They're controlled.
By who, you?
No.
By Okajnik?
Doyle winced as if in pain, and his right hand flew to his throat, gingerly touching it.
Who else?
Did he mutilate you like that?
Doyle's hand crept up almost involuntarily from his throat to the raw scars on his face.
These are his marks. He marks all of his beasts like this, so we'll know one another. You'll wear them too, soon enough, and like it.
Despite the ragged clothes he wore, Bridget could tell by the man's way of speaking and his face that he was not bred in the backwoods.
Where are you from, Samariumville?
The question seemed to startle him as if it had never occurred to him before. Doyle nodded slowly.
Yes, Samariumville, yes, historical division.
You're an archivist?
Yes, an archivist, yes.
Like me. That's what I was in Cobaltville.
Looks like we both chose the wrong time and place for a career change.
How did you know we were coming?
We have sources.
Someone watching us? Watching the redoubt?
Your arrival was foretold.
Foretold by who?
There is a woman in these swamps. She inherited certain abilities.
Are you talking about a doomseer, a doomie?
Doomies weren't necessarily psi-muties, but normals with true clairvoyant or telepathic abilities were extremely rare. Extrasensory and precognitive perceptions were the most typical abilities possessed by muties who appeared normal.
All I know is she foretold your coming. She has great gifts.
Speaking of gifts, why didn't you sink and drown in that bog?
Is that important?
I can understand it from the swampies with their double circulatory systems. When they hold their breaths, carbon dioxide builds up in their blood. And when it dissolves and forms bicarbonate ions, the ions probably bind to their red blood cells that carry oxygen, like in crocodiles.
Doyle put his hand to his mouth, and when he opened it, a bright pink glob of sputum gleamed in his palm.
You've got the plague.
All of us have it. All of his beasts. But it won't kill us.
Why not?
Okajnik kissed us. Immunized us.
What?
Doyle waved her words away impatiently, refusing to be distracted further.
I didn't come here to talk about that. You'll find out all about it soon enough, just like I did.
Then why did you come here? To whistle at me?
Yes. No.
He blinked rapidly. At first, Bridget thought his eye blinks were due to confusion. Then she realized he was trying to stem the tears brimming in his eyes. Tears of shame.
I've been sent to defile you. It's my duty as a beast. Help me!
Fear leaped through Bridget, but it was a different kind of fear than she had ever experienced before. It was mixed with a soul-cringing horror and sympathy, even as Doyle began to unbutton the fly of his trousers with shaking fingers.
It's a compulsion caused by the kiss, the sting. Biochemical imbalance, maybe. Endorphins and hormones all out of whack, probably.
Bridget drew up her legs, bending them at the knee. Doyle shuddered, hands frozen at the waistband of his pants, his face flushed and contorted.
Makes us act like beasts. Guess that's why he calls us his beasts. Makes sense? No, it doesn't make sense.
What are you going to do?
All the new beasts will take turns with you and your friend. After you've been defiled, you'll receive the kiss, and you'll live forever.
As beasts?
Doyle's face suddenly hardened. He jerked down his pants and moved toward her on his knees. Bridget didn't have much leverage with which to kick, but she tried, straightening her legs out and up like springs. Doyle caught her by the ankles and wrenched her violently forward. Her back scraped along the rough bark of the saplings, her elbows digging little grooves in the soft ground. She managed to keep her head up.
It's not me. It's not me.
He pulled her legs apart. Arching her back, Bridget twisted her body to one side, freeing her right leg with a fierce tug. She kicked him with all of her strength in the lower belly. She could tell it pained him, and she kicked him there again, this time pistoning her heel into his groin. Panic overwhelmed Bridget, causing her to freeze momentarily, then to thrash and flail madly at him with her free leg. She smashed the sole of her foot into his face, felt his nose collapse. At least a dozen times she drove her foot into his body and face. Doyle took it all, every blow. He let her kick him until she was utterly exhausted, panting and covered with sweat. She could barely muster up a feeble foot nudge, much less another kick. Blood trickled from his nostrils, oozed from split lips, crimson threads dripping from a lacerated eyebrow. His mouth opened and his tongue lolled out, the tip tentatively touching the scarlet stream from his nose. His tongue was dead white, as dry as sandpaper. Carefully, Doyle recaptured her right leg and again spread her legs apart.
It's not me. It's not me!
Doyle looked over his shoulder and let her foot go.
Here he is! He wants to meet you and your friend. Okajnik! Okajnik!
Doyle backed out of the lean-to, pulling his pants up. Bridget managed to sit up, catching her breath. The swampy surged and milled about eagerly. A figure strode into the firelight, and at the sight of him, Bridget started violently, her heart seeming to skip a beat, then began to pound again. Against the dancing flames, surrounded by the small, dark people, he shone like a star. The man smiled with a terrible beauty, repellent but magnetic. He wore black leather knee boots, black leggings, and a red shirt with billowy sleeves. He smiled broadly, his white teeth gleaming against his pale skin, contrasting with a fall of black hair. His yellow-green eyes were magnificent and invoked in Bridget a desire to please him. The swampies crowded and clustered around him, and he reached out and touched and patted them as if bestowing benedictions or stroking his pets. He radiated more than charisma. He exuded an aura of evil. Absolute, unregenerate, charming, and desirable evil. For the past 20 minutes, Grant and Kane had been alternately bemused, amused, and irritated. The jump from Montana had been clean, causing them to suffer only a few moments of disorientation. Their true disorientation didn't begin until they left the Mattrans chamber and started touring Redoubt 47. They found no clues that DeFore and Bridget had been there, but judging by the symbols painted on the walls and the hanging fetishes, someone paid regular visits to the installation. Kane thought the redoubt was a dump. Outside of the control room, they discovered that the overhead lights didn't work, so they were forced to rely on the amber beams provided by the Nighthawks. The mysteries posed by the totems and painted sigils bewildered both men, and since neither one enjoyed walking around in a state of bewilderment, they quickly grew tense and annoyed. It took them only a couple of minutes to establish that Bridget and DeFore weren't in range of the UTEL helmet comms, but reaching that conclusion induced more anxiety. The environmental suit served as another source of irritation. The helmets reduced their field of vision, seriously impaired their hearing, and limited all of their senses. As former hard contact magistrates, Kane and Grant were accustomed to relying on all of their finely honed instincts when entering a potential kill zone. Walking around in a high state of alert while wearing the suits was an exercise in futility, since they were essentially cut off from all external stimuli. All they could see was what lay directly ahead of them, and all they could smell was the compressed air provided by their tanks, and all they could hear was each other's respiration. Both men carried sin eaters strapped to their forearms, and long combat knives were scabbarded in web belts at their hips. The stripped-down subguns known as copperheads dangled from shoulder straps. The blasters were barely 2 feet in length. The magazines held 15 4.85mm steel-jacketed rounds, which could be fired at a rate of 700 per minute. Even with their optical image intensifiers and laser auto-target scopes, the copperheads weighed less than 8 pounds. Out in the main passageway, Kane and Grant checked each door, scanning the rooms that lay beyond. Most of them were completely bare, stripped of anything useful long ago. They entered a central barracks area, equipped with bunks, a few tables and chairs, a whirlpool bath, not to mention half a ton of ancient garbage. They crossed the large room to a door bearing a sign that read, "Entry to this biohazard section absolutely forbidden to all personnel below B-12 clearance." Grant rapped it with the barrel of his copperhead.
"Every time I'm on the verge of taking off this damn helmet, something like that reminds me of where we are."
"I don't need the reminder, but if we leave the redoubt, I think we can take them off.
Providing we can find our way out of here.
Baptiste and DeFore obviously managed it."
Grant turned away from the door.
"Some of these places have maps showing the layout. We need to find..." "Ow! God damn fucking shit!"
Kane turned to see Grant spin in an awkward circle like a dog trying to catch its tail. He was slapping furiously at his back.
"Something hit me!"
Kane saw nothing, then directed the microlight to the floor. The beam haloed the 8-inch arrow lying on the floor and glinted dully from the sticky substance smeared over its sharp point. A cold rush of recognition flooded his guts.
"We've got swampies in here."
Sin eaters sprang into both men's hands at the same time, and they swept the barracks room with their Nighthawks. Kane realized the arrows couldn't penetrate the tough layers of the environmental suits, but that wasn't much of an advantage. Standing back to back, they shone the microlights all around, their ragged breathing resounding in each other's ears. Grant held his copperhead in his left hand, with his sin eater hanging at waist level in his right. Both weapons were ready to unleash twin songs of doom at anything foolish enough to challenge them. They stepped carefully toward the partitioned corner that held the whirlpool bath.
"See anything?"
Before Kane could reply, he felt a stinging blow against his chest, directly on his left pectoral. He caught only a glimpse of the arrow bouncing away before he depressed the Sin-Eater's trigger stud. At least three of the rounds found their target, and a muscular swampy woman dressed in brown burlap dropped a crossbow. Her fingers tried to hold in her rapidly spilling guts. The driving force of the bullets easily flipped the woman backward, but she didn't fall. She struck the raised rim of the tub and used it as a brace to fling herself forward again.
What the fuck?
The woman smacked her hands over the new wounds and fell writhing to the floor. Almost immediately, she began struggling to her feet again. Kane fired three more rounds from his Sin-Eater. The bullets slammed into the swampy woman's forehead, tearing half-inch-wide holes through her skull. She went down again, but this time she didn't rise.
What the fuck was that?
Double circulatory and cardiovascular systems, remember? Aim for the head.
Grant nodded, noticing the primitive condition of her weapon. Like most Outlanders and Muti peoples, Swampies weren't keen on blasters, finding it difficult to keep them in good condition, and since the program of unification, much too hard to find the proper ammunition. Hunched in a tight posture, Kane narrowed his eyes and peered inside the partitioned enclosure, glancing long enough at the zone to assure himself the Swampy was indeed dead before scanning the rest of the area.
Clear?
Kane nodded as he started to step back.
Good thing they...
A bolt from a crossbow punched Kane in the diaphragm, its stinging impact knocking air from his lungs, doubling him up. A stocky figure with a crossbow rose from the bottom of the large round whirlpool tub and launched himself, holding a notch-bladed knife in both hands. In an instant, he landed on top of Kane, who felt the knife blade drag along the front of his suit. Forcing himself to carry on against the burning pain in his solar plexus, Kane whipped around with his copperhead, squeezing the trigger at point-blank range. The Swampy toppled over backward, most of his face dissolving in a welter of blood, bone, and brain. Kneading his midsection, Kane glared down at the dead man.
Bastard, you were saying? I was saying it's a good thing they've only got crossbows and knives.
Startled, Kane saw pinpoints of flame flickering from behind the tub, and his helmet literally seemed to jump beneath a shuddering drum roll. A spiderweb pattern of cracks spread across his faceplate until it broke. Kane and Grant dove, tucked, and rolled in opposite directions.
Son of a bitch! They've got blasters!
Neither man knew if the material of his garments was dense enough to turn bullets, but they weren't particularly inclined to put them to the test. The tall, shadowy blasterman behind the tub tracked them with streaks of full auto fire. Kane recognized that staccato roar. The man was using a Sin-Eater. The stuttering hail of bullets came ripping toward them, starting low and going high like rockets taking off in flight. Kane felt a numbing blow across his right hip as he came out of his roll. Extending both blasters, Kane pressed the triggers, smearing the shadows with dancing tongues of flame. Though he emptied both of his weapons, he achieved his objective. The gunman dropped out of sight behind the whirlpool. Grant threw himself in a reverse somersault, and he struck, back first, against the legs of a table, nearly overturning it. He saw the swampy horde appear first, looming out of the darkness. He counted 6, 7, no, 8 of the shuffling muties. Centering the red dot of the Copperhead's auto-targeter on the swampy who appeared to be more or less in the lead, he held the trigger, squeezing into the little subgun's recoil. The rounds nearly took the top of the head off the swampy. The other swampies scattered, running in a peculiar scampering gait. He had about half a second of triumph before he felt an agonizing vice-like grip on his upper left arm. He felt the stitches and edges of his knife wound pull apart. Grant glimpsed the scarred, silently snarling face just as the Muti yanked his 230-plus pounds up from the floor. Managing to rip the nearly indestructible fabric, the Swampy tossed him across the barracks room. Grant slapped the concrete floor chest first. The Copperhead went skittering out of his left hand. Kane rolled back up on the balls of his feet and turned to see Swampies crowding in around Grant's body, thrusting down at him with knives. Dropping the empty Copperhead, Kane ejected the Sin-Eater's spent clip with his right thumb and snapped in another with his left. His first two shots struck a Swampy full in the face. The next one caught a smaller man in the left side of the head. The fourth shot was a little low, blowing a piece out of the shoulder of a woman. Kane instantly corrected his aim and put another round through her forehead. The Muties scattered again into the murk, not wanting to face another volley. Grant forced himself first to his hands and knees, then he staggered erect.
If Bridget and Reba met up with those things...
Reba?
That's DeFore's first name. If these Swampies were in here when they arrived...
The blasterman behind the tub opened up again. Kane's Sin-Eater blazed in reply. Grant squeezed the trigger of his own hand blaster, shifting position so his and Kane's barrage constituted an improvised crossfire. By the strobing effect of the muzzle flashes, they saw the man throw up his right arm and clutch his throat with his left hand. He collapsed out of sight. Grant and Kane ceased firing, though Kane kept his blaster trained on the tub as Grant came toward him, swinging the smoking bore of his Sin-Eater in short back-and-forth arcs. He retrieved his copperhead, and the two men cautiously approached the whirlpool from opposite directions. By the illumination of their nighthawks, they saw a thick pool of blood, almost black in the dim light, spreading across the floor. A man wearing black molded body armor lay on his back between the tub and the rear wall. Blood from a throat wound pulsed up and over his gloved fingers. The red-tinted visor of his helmet glinted in the amber beams of the microlights.
Fuck, it's a mag.
Kane blinked in shock and groped for a response.
Maybe it's a swampy in Mag's armor.
Grant knelt beside the dead man, gingerly reaching for the underjaw locking guard of the helmet. A lucky bullet had ripped open the man's jugular vein in a tiny portion of his neck unprotected either by the high collar of the Kevlar undersheathing or the base of the helmet.
No. Look at his size, his bill, the color of his skin. He's not a swampy.
He undid the lock on the helmet and pulled it from the man's head. An unfamiliar face stared up at them. Fresh red cuts crisscrossed the flesh around his eyes.
He's scarred like the swampies, though. What the hell for? Where's he from?
Zomeriumville is the best guess.
Kane glanced around anxiously. He saw nothing but murk. Grant stood up, lips tightly compressed beneath his mustache.
This makes no damn sense at all.
He grimaced in pain and glanced down at his left arm. A flap of the suit's material hung loose.
That swampy bastard ripped this stuff. Lockesh said it was supposed to be indestructible.
I guess it's proof against anything but swampies. My faceplate's busted. These things are doing nothing for us now but blocking our vision.
Kane unzipped the seal of his suit's collar. Grant eyed him doubtfully.
What about bacteria?
It's not like we have a choice. Besides, the way those swampies move, it's easier to hear them before you see them.
After a thoughtful few seconds, Grant nodded in reluctant agreement and unzipped his own suit. Kane cautiously sniffed the air and made a face.
What is it?
Kane looked at him, surprised that Grant couldn't smell the scent of rotten eggs, of sulfur. Then he remembered that Grant's nose had been broken 3 times during his mag days and always poorly reset. Unless an odor was extraordinarily pleasant or virulently repulsive, he was incapable of detecting smells, unless they were right under his nostrils. A running joke among his fellow magistrates had been that Grant could eat a hearty dinner with a dead skunk lying on the table next to his plate. For the first time, Kane envied this impairment. However, Grant could feel the high temperature, at least in the mid-80s, and feel the fetid, sticky atmosphere. Sweat sprang out on their faces almost instantly. Generally speaking, the air inside a redoubt wasn't the freshest in the world, but the interior temperature, humidity, and air quality always seemed to be at the proper comfort level for humans.
Let's try to find our way out of here. It's a sure bet those sons of bitches won't let us back to the gateway.
Kane moved quickly but cautiously across the room to the door bearing the biohazard sign.
This looks to be the only way out of here.
Grant hesitated, gritted his teeth, then nodded. Kane used the barrel of his copperhead to push the bar down while Grant palmed the door to one side. The chamber beyond held an old computer and medical equipment. After listening for any sound for a few moments, they entered, walking quickly through it, paying no attention to the animal carcasses hanging from the ceiling. The two went through a door on the far side of the room and found themselves in a narrow corridor. At its end, they were just able to make out the foot of a stairway, lit very feebly by light from somewhere above it. The air was moister and warmer, and the stench of sulfur was now so strong even Grant fingered his nose.
Oh, that is foul.
Yeah.
They made their way down the passageway and up the stairs, pausing every few seconds to scan ahead and behind them.
You think they gave up?
Those snake-loving Indians give up?
Point taken.
They reached the top of the steps and came to a dead stop. The sector stood open, showing off a night sky filled with starlight. There was a nearly full moon hanging low in the sky, and the lack of cloud cover allowed it to shine down at full wattage, so while their vision was limited, they weren't blind either. The two men inched out of the redoubt door, looking and listening for any sort of threat, but none appeared to be forthcoming. They did a quick scan of the ground surrounding the redoubt door, gazing out at the cypress, live oak, and sycamore trees, their leafy branches reaching high into the night sky. Glancing down at the ground, Kane saw the imprint of a treaded boot sole in the marshy ground, a match for the pattern on the boots they wore.
One of them came this way.
I wonder who.
Leaving their helmets just inside the open sector, they followed the tracks into the undergrowth. The swamp was thick all around them, the heavy-leaved interlocking branches pressing in everywhere. Even the moonlight held a queasy green tint. Still, combined with the beams of their nighthawks, there was sufficient light to follow the trail. Kane, taking point as always, used his combat knife to slash branches that blocked their way. The tracks were intermittent, but they were enough to provide a trail to follow. Every few minutes they stopped to listen for any sounds of pursuit. They entered a small clearing, and Kane's sixth sense rang an alarm, and he came to a halt so suddenly that Grant, wiping sweat from his face, bumped into him. Kane lurched forward, stumbled, and his right leg sank up to the knee in a thick mingling of mud and water. Grabbing him by the arm, Grant pulled him backward. His leg came free from the sucking, clinging bog.
Sorry.
Kane scanned the area with slitted eyes, shining his microlight around the foliage bordering the quagmire. The beam struck an object that reflected the light. At the edge of the bog, they saw a helmet from an environmental suit lying in the shrubbery. Kane picked it up. A small spattering of dried blood showed on the interior of the faceplate. Dropping the helmet, Kane looked toward the far side of the bog. He saw flattened grass and broken foliage. Without a word, they moved forward into an almost perfect ambush.